Okay, good afternoon, Professor Yu. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've exchanged ahead of this conversation, the theme of our series of interviews is the history of replica symmetry breaking in physics, which we roughly bound chronologically between 1975 and 1995. But before we get into the meat of the subject, we have a couple of questions on background to situate your own contributions. So first, can you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university?
I grew up in suburban Boston. Just went to the public high school there, Lincoln Sudbury High School. Very good school. And I was sort of born into this. Both of my parents have degrees in physics. My father worked as an electrical engineer at Raytheon, which was a defense contractor. And my mother was a computer programmer, actually. She actually programmed the ILIAC in the 1950s. My father was at Illinois for a master's degree, and my mother had that as a job.
Wow.
But this was the 50s. Actually, my mother was smarter than my father. It should have been the other way around. My mother should have been going for a PhD and my father working to support him, but it was the 1950s, so
So what then led you to pursue a degree in physics at UMass Amherst? I guess that was part of that
well, we lived in
family.
Massachusetts, and the deal with my parents was if I went to an expensive school, I had to pay part of the tuition. Whereas if I went to UMass, it was fine, and it was a good school. I tried a few other. I sort of knew I liked physics from studying it in high school, but I tried a couple other things, chemistry, engineering, math, but I like solving problems and I didn't like doing proofs and I like math. So physics was the theoretical physics was the natural place where I was comfortable.
So what drew you then to pursue graduate studies at Cornell and with Michael Fisher in statistical mechanics in particular from there?
So at UMass there was a professor named Bob Guyer. Who I did a project with him my senior year, and he wanted to learn about renormalization group and percolation, and so he got me going on that. He didn't know much about it either, and so we had a lot of fun learning that kind of stuff. And he had been at Cornell, so he had been a student at Cornell. And then there was another professor who was a very good teacher. I liked Gene Golowich, who had also been at Cornell, and so they knew people at Cornell. And so I ended up at Cornell, and I was lucky. Michael Fisher sort of had a cycle. He'd have some students, and then he'd finish them up and take a sabbatical. So he had been at sabbatical at Caltech, and he came back. He didn't. So he was at the point of taking on students. So I was there was good timing there for me, but just by chance. And so I started working with him, which of course was a wonderful decision.
How did the thesis topic came about? Was it your idea? Was it Michael's, Professor
No, he
Fisher's
was
idea?
working on, so this was about commensurate and commensurate transitions and that kind of related stuff. And he was working on those things already. There was a he'd probably been a, and there was this guy, Walter Selka, who he had been working with on these problems, who probably had been a postdoc before I got to Cornell. And they had some work. And we started working on those problems. Julia Yeomans was there. I worked with her a little bit.
Can you give us a general feel of what was the statistical physics community at Cornell at that time?
Well, in
The Professor Fisher's group and the other groups also that were there.
Physics there was a lot of theoretical activity. Fisher and Ben Widom sat in the chemistry department. I don't think Ben Widom was even a professor of physics. Michael Fisher was, as he loved to say, professor of chemistry, mathematics, and physics. But he sat in the chemistry department, which he had been chair of. And so we had this little suite of offices, which was Whittam and Fisher together, which was a lot going on there. a lot of good postdocs coming through, and Whittam actually had an experimental lab as well. So they were doing multiple fluid phase separation, kind of, multicritical and, stuff, phase diagrams involving multi-component fluids and phase transitions, and wetting and interface tensions and all that kind of stuff. So, it was very stimulating. So we interacted a lot with Ben Whittam's group. And then, there was David Merman and Neil Ashcroft, Vinay Ambedkar, John Wilkins, Eric Sidja. It's just an amazing group of people, Ken Wilson, an amazing group of Jim Krumfonsel, and I'm not even remembering everyone. It was just an amazing time to be at Cornell.
There be joint group meetings?
Low temperature physics group was doing, experimental activity was really strong. I was just so lucky. In some sense, it's sort of a shame that Cornell isn't what it was then. It's one of the places which hasn't been able to keep that up, unfortunately.
But were there joint group meetings, or there were seminar series, or did this play sort of day to day?
Yeah, lots of, Michael had a weekly seminar, and, Whittam would have, not so often, but Mike, lots of people. I remember, John, all these people, the first time I saw them, when they came, John Cardi, John Macda, whoever, those are the two I just come to mind right away, a lot of people, Steve Shanker, first time I met them was when they came and gave the seminar there. Had this seminar room up on there. You've been there, presumably. Although that's changed now. So the building, Clark Hall, the seventh floor, had these windows out over the, and it just had this gorgeous view across the valley and the lake. And so we had this seminar room where Michael would meet, and we'd have lunch and just this amazing, beautiful view of over Ithaca and Cayuga Lake. And
so upon graduating,
of course, there was lots of condensed, which is more called condensed matter stuff from the department
as well. So the relationship between physics and chemistry were fairly transparent, or was there any obvious barriers, or?
No. I was in the, we had three of us in the office, three grad students in the office where I was sitting. Two of us were physics student and one was a chemistry student. Grad student, but it really didn't matter. Of course, details mattered, but there was a lot of back and forth. But I was, I was really in the physics department, and I didn't do much in the chemistry department other than Whittam and Fisher. Mm-hmm. I sat in the chemistry department, but it was just like a short walk down the corridor into the physics building.
So upon graduating, you went to work at Bell Labs. What drew you to leave a more academic setting and go to Bell Labs then?
Bell Labs was an academic setting. So this was, this was a long time ago, Bell Labs at that time was the top condensed matter physics laboratory in the world, by a substantial margin. So in terms of doing condensed matter and being in contact with all the activity, I think it was much more active than any university department. Of course, that changed. I sort of saw just the tail end of it change while I was there. And you look at all these people, that was a standard career path back then, was if you can go to Bell Labs, go to Bell Labs, stay a few years, and then you go back to academia. Very, very standard, and academia is full of people my age and a bit older who followed that career path. Mm-hmm.
So what was the group you were part of, or who were you interacting with in general when you started Bell Labs in particular?
So there was the theory department, and the theory department was in the a physical sciences laboratory. So Bell Labs was was different than a university in that the ratio of experimentalists to theorists was more appropriate, given that physics is an experimental science. The place was 80 or 90% experimentalists, and I interacted a lot with experimentalists while I was there. Physicists, and then there was an area that was sort of more material science, chemistry, but there were some physicists in there, John Weeks and Wim von Sarlos and Pierre Hohenberg, and well, eventually Pierre Hohenberg became my department head. But there was this other section of theorists, John Tully. So they were sort of more physical chemists, Frank Stillinger. So there was a lot of really good theorists who were in the sort of more chemistry, physical chemistry laboratory. I forget what it was called. What's the guy's name? There's some a bunch of good polymer chemists. In fact, the guy who just won the Nobel Prize was there,
Lou
Louis
Bruce.
Proust. But there were some polymer theorists. N names aren't coming back to me. There were a lot of experimentalists, but there were 30 or 40, serious theorists also, doing research in physics and physical chemistry. And also we interacted quite a bit with some of the ma mathematicians. There were some probabilists. I actually went to Peter Shor's first talk about I had no clue what I was seeing, but there was this probability group. There were, and given, they were somewhat interested in statistical physics problems, and I sometimes interested in what they were doing. And so I used to go to their seminars, and I happened to go to Peter Shor's seminar. I had no clue what I was seeing. But
So at that point, you were, from what I understand, mostly free to choose your own research problems. How
yeah, if
did
you're
you?
performing well, so Bell Labs was very, very, very strong feedback. Very much a meritocracy. So if you're performing well, you had complete freedom. If you're a theorist, right? If you're an experimentalist, of course, you had to get approval for buying things because people didn't really have. We weren't supposed to apply for outside funding, so the funding would just come through the company. And so, the experimentalists, of course, had to ask for money when they needed something, and so there was a management. But the management, you had to go about five layers up in management before it wasn't a PhD physicist. The management really understood what we were doing, and you'd really get feedback. And people get fired if they were underperforming. They'd get fired or told to leave, whatever. It's not that harsh, but they wouldn't be told to leave next week, but they get fired. You'd get a when you were young, you could get a raise that was 5%, or you get a raise that's 25%, depending upon what the department heads would get together every year. They call it whatever, I forget what they call it, and they would evaluate the people, and they'd really make distinctions. It was a very different environment. And also the other thing is there were a few postdocs. It was a real privilege to have a postdoc or a technician. So a lot of the experimentalists, they would work with each other. Often they'd have to just work by themselves because they didn't have a postdoc or a technician. So that was the kind of thing, they wouldn't give out a lot of. They would had young people and they wanted them to work with each other. And if a postdoc or a technician would help, they would give it. But an awful lot of the experimentalists didn't have a student, they didn't have a postdoc, they didn't have a technician, but they got a lot of good stuff done by just working with other people. And then they would leave if they wanted a bigger group, they would leave, right? And that was the culture, is stay for 5, 10, 15 years, and And if you're, you know, if you're really just a researcher, go to the university and send it. That's what they would say. Go to the university and send us your best students. So the idea is when the people leave, it's an improvement because you lose them, but you get all their best students back. And that was the culture.
I see.
I was fortunate to see the end of it, right? It pretty much was over by the time I was there for 13 years, and it was pretty much over by the time I left.
Mm-hmm. So how did the first topics of research came to you then? How did you manage to prove your worth and to stay initially?
I found things to work on. Daniel, but Daniel Fisher, you know, he was the person I talked with the most. But initially, he, you know, I guess that again was part of it as they were evaluating me. And so, you know, he was not actively collaborating with me and having me show what I could do on my own. But, you know, we talked a bit. I was fortunate at the time. I don't know if you know this, but at the time there was this, it was just the beginning of conformal field theory. And they did this thing where they found an infinite sequence of models whose exponents they knew. I forget what the precise name of this was. Fridan, Chu, and Shankar, and then also the Russians, Shamolodchikov and Polyakov. And I knew about that probably because Daniel told me about it, but it wasn't something he was working on. And then I was also reading these exact solution papers from Baxter and company. I'd actually worked on, I had done a little project as a couple of things as a graduate student where I was sort of mining Baxter, I called it. So Baxter, you know, could do all the, this is Rodney Baxter. So he could do all these exact solutions, but he didn't really have a feel for the scaling theory and the normalization group. So he would sort of just put the formulas out there, but he wouldn't really go take them apart and, you know, in some sense, think about them from the, you know, Wilsonian RG point of view. And so I had done that a couple of times where I, you know, went into some of their papers and you just got out some good stuff that they hadn't been able to notice because they just weren't looking at it from that point of view. Right. It wasn't something which was obvious from the mathematical approach they were using. But when you bring in the physics view, you know, you see, oh, it's got to have this scaling. It was actually there was this amusing incident where I wrote this. They had this model. This is Andrews, Baxter, and Forrester. So they had this class of models, the hard hexagons, and they had four different critical points. And one thing I discovered is one of them was a multi-critical point in a way that they didn't understand. You know, they just saw it as a critical point because mm-hmm. they only went through it in one direction. And I was able to, for three of these points, which they all got from the same mathematics, I was able to pull out, you know, corrections to scaling and, you know, just describe everything in terms of scaling theory. But the fourth one, I couldn't see it, right? And so I wrote up this paper and I sent it to Baxter and when I made a conjecture, you know, this fourth one should also have some structure like this, but I can't see how to get it out from your hypergeometric functions because, you know, I wasn't good at hypergeometric functions. And he had this thing where he had some very early version of something like Mathematica where it would just do these power series and get all these patterns out. And he just found it, right? He could expand out these functions in a power series and just see the patterns and make conjectures, right? And then find the formula in Ramanujan. You know, and he sent me this thing back saying, you know, showing me how he found it. You know, that he found the formula which, you know, fit with my conjecture. So anyways, I had been doing that kind of stuff. And so I knew these exact solutions. And so I was probably the only one in the world who knew, you know, Andrews, Baxter, Forrester in a fair amount of detail. And they had an infinite sequence of multi-critical points. And these conformal field theorists who had an infinite sequence of multi-critical points. And it was just numerology. They just matched beautifully, you know, and it's just nobody else had looked at them both at the same time. But then I was able to put that. So I think that was probably the highlight of my sort of I guess you would call it non-tenure, you know,
probation period.
For the first year and a half when I was there, I didn't have, quote, tenure, you know, as a postdoc, basically. And that was probably the highlight. But, you know, there were a few other things.
So you mentioned Danielle Fisher. I mean, you already knew him from your thesis days, from my understand. You were thanking him already. I mean, you thanked him in your thesis. I don't, as someone you had conversations with.
Yeah.
So can you describe a bit the nature of your relationship?
I had met. So we used to go to the Rutgers meeting. You know, Joel Leibowitz's meeting. So that was a standard thing for Fisher's group, as we'd all pile in a station wagon and twice a year to go down to here, you know, right near here, to Rutgers. And so I would see Daniel there. What happened is the summer before I graduated, so I graduated in 83, the summer of 82. Yeah, so I had met Daniel, and, you know, of course there was a family connection. And so I was invited, or anyways, it was suggested. I don't know if it was Michael's idea or whatever. So I spent a summer, the summer before the summer when I graduated, I spent the summer at Bell Labs. I certainly got to know Daniel then. Yeah.
Okay.
So I knew him pretty well by the time of my last year of graduate school. Yeah, because of that, I had spent the summer at Bell Labs.
Is he the one who recruited you to Bell Labs? Is that how it worked, or this was a completely
separate basically, process?
Basically. Okay. I see.
I remember there was a phone call from Bill Brinkman to my wife, which I think was pretty important to convince her that it's not so bad moving to New Jersey. We're still here.
So your first...
Bill Brinkman was two levels up in the management. It's Bill Brinkman.
Okay.
So he was, I guess they call that laboratory director.
So your first work actually on spin glasses was a paper with the late Ingo Morgenstern, who was then, I think, a postdoc at Bell Labs, if I understand the roles. And I think he was mostly working with Andrew Ogielski or Andy Ogielski.
Yeah. So Ogielski had this project, you know, he built a special purpose computer and stuff, and he invited Ingo. I think Ingo was her Binder student, I think. I'm not positive of that.
Van Hemmen, I think, but yes.
Oh, is Van Hemmen? Okay, I'm sorry. But anyways, Ingo came, and yeah, I used to talk with him quite a bit. And we did this transfer matrix calculation. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. So was that, but that, I had probably already done the paper with Chris Henley about domain walls and random ferromagnets. So that was also, you know, that was sort of my first. So, you know, in the work before that, I had never done anything with disorder, you know, with quench disorder, you know, none of my thesis work or anything, or my early work at Bell Labs. But then we did this first project on the domain wall and the two-dimensional Ising random bond ferromagnet. Where we were able to get out that scaling, which now we know is KPZ, right? It was one of the early pre-KPZ versions of that scaling, which also had been known before from hydrodynamics, from the Forsberger's equation.
But is it through Henley or through Morgenstern that you first learned about spinning glasses, or did you know about these systems already because they were in the air at Bell Labs or elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a good question how I first learned about it. You know, it was probably something that there would be seminars on. Well, Henley had worked on spin glasses with Sompolinski and Halperin. So I might have learned about it first from Chris. Sompolinski used to visit Bell Labs a lot, so I might have learned about it from Sompolinski. And he was working with Daniel. Actually, you know, and I might have learned it from Daniel, because Daniel had been working. Yeah, he had a paper with Sompolinski. I'm not sure when that was. So it was around.
Okay. So, I mean, was it? It was not through Anderson, who was also around, would have been a source of exposure.
Yeah, you know, Anderson was checking out of Bell Labs then. He was sort of moving. Daniel had been there a few more years. You know, he went there a few years before I did. And, you know, him and Philly used to talk a lot. But by the time, I never really talked with Phil. You know, when I came to Princeton, I used to talk with him all the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was around, but I hardly interacted with him at Bell Labs. You know, he would come. I think he may have already moved down here. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't coming to Bell Labs very often. And yeah. And somehow, yeah, he wasn't, maybe he was just focused on other things, or he may not have thought I was a person worth spending his valuable time at Bell Labs talking with. I don't know. It's actually surprises me how little interaction I had with Phil. And, you know, there was all that. Eventually, spin glasses became such a big activity at Bell Labs, you know, both experimentally and theoretically. And Phil just didn't seem to be particularly involved. Yeah.
I see. I mean, how influential was the numerical work of Andy Ogielski in you pursuing ideas of spin glasses? Is this how what ticked you first?
I think that was actually didn't really get results till afterwards.
Okay.
No, I think the way, you know, Daniel and I were doing, you know, I did this. It was really about interfaces in random media. You know, Daniel was, you know, I did this thing with Chris Henley, and then Daniel was doing pin charge density waves, and then there was Imre Ma and random fields. And then we did a bunch of papers about, you know, various problems, interfaces in magnets and whatever. And so I view it as it came out of that.
I mean, in your first papers, I mean, now we're diving into it, and we've already talked a bit about how you got started, but how did the idea of looking at, you mentioned the ideas of low energy excitations in disordered systems came about, but in your papers, you also mentioned the work of Brian Moore and McMillan on domain walls as motivation.
Particularly McMillan. Yeah, McMillan was the first one. So McMillan had, and he actually was building a special purpose computer too. I don't know if you knew that. And he had some very nice papers about the two-dimensional spin glass and the Nishimuri line and that phase diagram. And so those were very important.
So you were following that literature
when I got into it, certainly McMillan's papers were, you know, something, you know, and then he passed away right around that time. He had an accident. I guess he was bicycling and he got hit by a car or something. And so we sort of, you know, viewed what we were doing was, you know, carrying on. He had been at Bell Labs. McMillan had actually been at Bell Labs, you know, I'm not sure. I think he'd only been at Illinois for a few years. He also spent the first decade or so of his career at Bell Labs. We were very much building on what he had done. And of course, Bray and Moore were doing roughly the same thing at the same time.
So were you in touch with McMillan and or Bray and Moore, or was this all through the paper trail that these ideas came
to? Yeah, I'm pretty sure by the time I got started on it, I'm pretty sure McMillan was gone by then. I don't remember ever interacting. You know, I think one of those papers was, one or two of those papers were actually posthumous. I'm pretty sure. One of those domain, one or two of those domain wall papers were actually somebody, you know, the student who was working with him or something, you know, put it together and published it after he died. Although I'm not positive of that, but you can, I'm sure you can find out.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. I had met Macmillan much earlier when I was a student. I had been out to Illinois once as a grad student, but no, we were very much aware of the work, but we didn't have an interaction with him.
From your first PRL already, you pointed out that what you found as behavior was very different from the infinite range model, and I quote, how familiar were you with the mean field or infinite range description at that point, and how had you become acquainted with this material itself?
Well, we knew about it, and you know, one of the questions we were asking ourselves is, can we come up with some, you know, rather concrete phenomenology which could instantiate that in a short range model, right? And I think, you know, we were asking ourselves, can we come up with such a thing? And we couldn't. And in some sense, nobody really ever has, as far as I know, you know, in terms of something really concrete, right? You know, it can't be ruled out as a possibility, and people are trying to, you know, hem in what the possibilities are, but there's no real concrete description of how that would work. But we were, yeah, no, we were very much aware of that, and you know, did think about whether we could somehow tweak what we were doing to include something like that, but we couldn't see any way to make that work.
But can you tell me a bit more about
those ideas? What had been around for what, more than five? When was the first Parisi paper? Was 79 or something, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So those ideas had definitely been around, and yeah, we were well aware of them.
But was it through reading the literature again, or had you been in touch with people who from that community, or was there a particular, I don't know, set of lecture notes that was circulating that you found useful? How did it make it to your consciousness, if you have any recollection?
My guess is it went to Sompolinski, and then Sompolinski to Fisher, and Fisher to me.
Okay.
I've never been a good reader. Right. I, you know, there probably were seminars and journal club. We used to have this journal club where, you know, people would go over papers. So, you know, it could have been something like that. But yeah, I was never much of a reader. Mm-hmm. I still am not much of a reader. You know, I get information mostly from talking with people and going to seminars, and you know, it's only once I really know something that I have the patience to actually read the papers. You know, because once you know what you're doing, then reading the papers can be a pleasure. But when you don't know what it's about, it's hard work.
How was your first work on this topic received?
Yeah, I think it was, I would say well received.
I mean, did you give lots of seminars? Did you, in correspondence with people or all of these?
Yeah, certainly we'd be giving talks. Yeah. That was, that was the main thing I was giving talks about for, until Vortex class. Between that point and when, you know, we started really doing, vortices, statistical mechanics of vortices and high temperature superconductors. You know, that was my main thing I would give talks about.
So can you tell us a bit about what was the talk circuit was? Or was it just going to Rutgers and give the talks there? Or were you traveling nationally or internationally to give seminars on this topic? What sort of attention was it receiving, in other words?
Well, you know, I remember colloquium at Stanford, you know, probably a few other places. I would imagine, though I don't know, you know, I would I would be surprised if there wasn't a March meeting invited talk, because that was a big thing at Bell Labs. That was, nominate each other for March meeting invited talks, and it was considered something you should do. So I'm sure that happened, but I don't even really remember. I'm sure it was being discussed. Like in the summer there were Gordon conferences. So there was a Condensed Matter Gordon conference, and I'm pretty certain this would have been a topic those days. And a lot of people would be there, and there'd be a session about this, about spin glasses, because there was a lot of experimental activity at the same time, right?
Were you in touch still with your PhD advisor? Do you know how Professor Fisher reacted to these ideas?
Well, I think he was positive. I'm trying to remember whether, I don't remember anything
particular
strong, but he was always very supportive and positive of everything I did. He never, he could be aggressive sometimes, but he never sent that in my direction.
I mean, these ideas were developed over a series of papers, right, over a number of years. Can you walk us through a bit how the program developed, how these ideas sort of became refined, or in response to what were they pushed in a direction or another?
Yeah. You're talking about particularly my work or
your work on spin glasses, in finite dimensional spin glasses, for sure. I mean, was it in response to experimental results, or were there computational results, or were you getting
certainly the
theorists, or
the computational results were very important. In that, you could, and eventually, right, of course, we could do one dimension, you just do it, right? It's exactly solvable, right? So that we did, of course. And then two dimensions, when we first started it, the two-dimensional work was, the numerical work was reasonably good, but still primitive compared to what it is now. And so people started really pushing on that, and part of that was my thing with Ingo Morgenstern. But people kept pushing on that. And in fact, my most recent work on spin glasses was with Alan Middleton, just 12 or so years ago, where, we really made some more progress on the two-dimensional case. And we actually figured out, very much because of the really powerful numerics he was able to do, and his student, I forget the student's name, Creighton Thomas, I think, on that paper, we're able to figure out how the droplet theory for the plus minus J square lattice Ising model works. And it's actually much more intricate than you would have naively thought. It was the kind of thing where, it's like, it's something Daniel and I could have fantasized about, but we didn't even try to think about that carefully. Because back then, it was believed, I guess because of some work of Kardar, Larry Soule and Mehran Kardar did some nice numerics on the plus minus J model, but they could only do up to a certain size. And if you don't do a big enough size, it's consistent with a zero temperature critical point. And so for like 20 years, the conjecture was the plus minus J square lattice Ising spin glass has a zero temperature critical point, kind of like a lot of other frustrated Ising models do, right? And so it was very comfortable because there were all these exact solutions which also had zero temperature critical points. But then, basically what happened is Alan Middleton, was pushing on that with, you know, numerics, you know, and going up to like 1,000 by 1,000, and it just wasn't holding together. And so he got in touch with me, you know, at, I think it was 2010 or something. And we, you know, worked that out. Right. So that's the numerics in 2D, mm-hmm. You know, which, you know, by now, you know, and what was interesting about that is, you know, that business with the, so first of all, the continuous distribution in 2D, the original data has really held up, right? It was just a matter of getting the exponents a little more precisely, you know, what's theta, what's the fractal dimension, but the picture that was already there in Macmillan has held up, right? Even when people use these modern algorithms to do these enormous systems. So that's really held up. And then the plus minus J, you had this thing where there was something fishy, and then there was like 10 years around, you know, 2000 to 2010, where people were saying, oh, something's fishy, what's going on here? There were a number of papers. But then when, you know, Alan did the work, which I was involved in, that seemed to just stop it, because that seemed like that was the answer. And nobody really has followed up on that, which I assume means people accept that answer. So that's now, so two dimensions seems pretty much under control, although you know, there's probably other cases with plus minus J models on different lattices which might behave rather differently, because mm-hmm. but nobody seems to have bothered to check that out. Yeah, and then there was the three dimensions, you know, Robin Bott and Peter Young were doing serious numerics. So that was another bit of spin glass that was going on at Bell. So Robin Bott, when I first got there for my permanent, or what became a permanent job, Robin Bott was on sabbatical, and he had taken sabbatical in Paris and then in London with Peter Young, and he was getting into spin glasses, which was kind of a new thing for him as a serious stat mech thing. He had been doing sort of more, you know, spins in, you know, he'd been doing other disordered spin system problems for other reasons. And so he was away, and I actually sat in his office for, well, he was away. And so I started, you know, he also brought back the spin glass problem from his sabbatical. And they had done some very nice numerics, as were a lot of, you know, a lot of people were doing it then. Rajiv Singh and Sudeep Chakravarti were doing the high temperature expansions soon after that, to try to, you know, see what you could learn there.
Was there any
in some sense it's the, you know, the critical point, you know, the numerics is probably pretty good for, you know, when you get above two dimensions, you know, the numerics is probably pretty good for doing the critical point and the high temperature phase, but mm-hmm. doesn't seem to have really helped very much with resolving any issues in the spin glass phase itself, which is unfortunate.
So I'd like to take you back to the 80s, really the 85 to 90 period, or an 88 period more specifically. Was there any theoretical pushback on these ideas, or was this broadly accepted from everyone who heard them? Or,
well, you know, there were, you know, it's the same as it is now, right? There's the ordered phase of the spin glass. It's not clear what the situation is, and there are people who like the infinite range model scenario, and there's people who like the more low dimension viewpoint of it, you know, the droplet theory or things in between, you know. And so that's a controversy which started then, mm-hmm. and still goes today, right?
You know, but were you in touch with the groups in Rome and in Paris, or was this with other people in the US, or what is, you know, who was the controversy with in these early days?
Well, I think it, yeah. Yeah, for me, it's just mostly in the papers. I don't remember, ever being at a conference and having heated arguments or things like that. Probably that happened. Daniel is much more emotional about these things than I am. So it probably happens sometimes when he's there.
So there was a back and forth in the literature already in these early years?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
although, in some sense, some of the work done purporting to support infinite range model behavior in short range models tends to be written completely ignoring our point of view, right? So in that sense, it's not a back and forth, right? In that they're not saying, like a lot of times they have some data that's perfectly consistent with both scenarios, but then they'll just say, oh, it looks like infinite range model, and they won't even talk about the other scenario, right? And so in that sense, sometimes there isn't the back and forth there really should be.
But my impression, and maybe I'm wrong, right, but was that most of this literature came in the 90s and 2000s, really, of the numerical work, say, looking at finite range systems with a lens of infinite range. But maybe I'm wrong. So were there specific back and forth already between 85 and 88 in that respect?
There were a lot of different people doing numerics and interpreting them a lot of different ways.
Okay.
So I don't know. It really was a very active subject with a lot of numerical work of very mixed quality, being published. And so I would be amazed if there wasn't already some papers being published, with simulations of short range models being interpreted in terms of infinite range model already in the 80s. But I don't know that because, it wouldn't have been high quality numerical work. So, I wouldn't have really remembered it. Right. Most of the numerical work on spin glasses is pretty, it just doesn't prove it. It's just not useful.
So you don't remember anything in particular, let's say from 85 to 88 of either numerics or theory or experiments that would be in direct debate. So would it be fair then to describe that this first sequence of paper, or this actually the core sequence of paper, was really just pursuing your own program without being challenged? Or that's
I think so, yeah. And then, there was this other thing, which is the non-equilibrium stuff and the chaos, which is, so that was another thing we were doing was thinking about the non-equilibrium dynamics and the pinnings of the walls, which you can think about in, random bond, random field, spin glass, and all the dynamics. And then once you start thinking about the spin glass problem from that point of view, you get this chaos, both under changing the random bonds and also chaos under changing the temperature, because the free energy of the domain walls is an almost cancellation of a much bigger energy and entropy. And so that all was also worked out at that time. And that occurs, that aspect of it, the temperature chaos and disorder chaos, there the two approaches, you get that in all models of spin glasses, right? And so that doesn't discriminate between the models. And so that was and that's actually a subject where there was a lot of nice experiments, all the aging phenomena, And so I think, that was probably the part of it that, produced the immediate activity you know, right afterwards was, you know, bringing in that aspect of it. And then realizing that, you know, most Spinglass experimental data, unless you're working, you know, around the critical point or above the critical point, if you're working in the phase, that you shouldn't be thinking, you should just be always thinking about it as out of equilibrium and you know, really engaging with it being out of equilibrium and studying all these aging and chaos effects. So I think that was, you know, in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, I think that was the main activity. And not so much the issue of, oh, is it droplets or is it infinite range, right? Because there was a lot of nice physics to get out, which was sort of independent of that.
In many instances in your papers, you describe the approach or the infinite range approach as being the results of the Parisi ansatz, the Parisi solution, the Parisi picture. So you very much tie this school of thought or this representation with Parisi. Were you at all in touch with him about these matters? Was there correspondence?
No, at least not me.
Okay. So why did you associate it so strongly with him then? Or,
well, why wouldn't we? It just, you know, it's his work.
Sure. I mean, there's also there's other papers, right? There's the early works from the 79 and 80, and then there's a collaboration with Marc Mézard and other authors in 84, 85. But in your minds, or I guess it was dominated.
It was him by himself got it started. Mm-hmm. There's no ambiguity about that, right?
Yes.
At least it doesn't seem that way to me. Right. It seems like it's his thing, and then other people joined in. Yes, but you know, that's I guess just, you know, it was maybe just shorthand, but I don't think it was inappropriate. Right.
In by the early 90s, you have a paper where you do mention the many states versus two states controversy. Your words again. What was the controversy by then? Since, as we've sort of figured out, there was nothing really happening between 85 and 88 in terms of controversy. So what changed maybe between 88 and 91 so that you identified?
Well, I think that was, we were sort of more trying to make these things more precisely defined, the distinctions between, you know, which is something, you know, other people have followed up on, you know, certainly Newman and Stein and Creed. You know, we were, you know, there were, at that time, it was really just these two scenarios, you know, and now we have some ones that are more intermediate, but we were just trying to, you know, make them as well-defined as we knew how to make them, those distinctions, and say what we could say. But, you know, there certainly was this big gap, right? We had this, you know, low dimensional picture, short range model picture, which clearly applied well in two dimensions. And then we have this infinite range model, which, you know, is infinite range. You might think of it as infinite dimension, although that wasn't entirely clear. And that's an awful big gap between two dimension short range and infinite range, right? And you know, the question is, you know, what do you do in between, you know, and trying to make it.
I mean, I understand.
Make it precisely defined and outline what the possibilities were, right? And
I mean, I think I understand this. What I'm trying to get at is, was this playing out at meetings where people were having discussions about this controversy knew?
Those...
Or was this taking place in personal correspondence or... Because it's not obvious in the paper trail where the controversy was brewing, if you want.
No, I would say that so there were two papers that Daniel and I wrote along those lines at that time. You know, as far as I can see, that was really just, you know, Daniel trying to make these things, you know, precise as he could at the time and get it written down. I guess I don't know to what extent anybody else was paying a lot of attention to it at that time. You know, I think it's, you know, I think Daniel appreciated, you know, okay, so there was the Rand and Field Ising model prompt, mm-hmm. right? Which had a controversy also, right? Of a different sort, but, you know, somewhat similar flavor.
But I understand what actually did take place in public and had people.
Yeah,
actually,
well, that was very different. That was very different in that it was much more aggressive, mm-hmm. and in public. Yes. But that one, you know, John Imbrie, the mathematical physicist, cleaned it up, right? And resolved it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the spin glass ever gets resolved, that's probably how it's going to be resolved. And I think, you know, Daniel had been working very heavily in the Rand-Field Ising problem. And so I think the idea was to try to get that process started of having, you know, serious mathematical physicists look at this problem and see if they can start untying some of these knots. And so I think that's why Daniel, Daniel was much more motivated in those papers than I was. You know, of course I was a co-author, but it was sort of his thing to get those done and out there. And that's what I think. You know, it was the purpose there was, to try to begin that process of mathematical physics trying to come in here and make some progress, right? Which happens. It's happened slowly over the years since then, mm-hmm. Although not enough to resolve the issue, but certainly to constrain the possible solutions. And I think you're pretty sure Newman and Stein. Mm-hmm. Very much following on those works, right? I don't know how many other people are, but I certainly, I talk occasionally with Dan Stein in particular, right? And, he definitely was influenced by those papers.
So if I try to rephrase this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially it was presented in these words in part to try to entice or to hook another community to pick up these problems, not necessarily that there was really this burning events, a la RFIM, or it could also have been taking place more quietly through referee reports, right? That's another place where controversy could have.
Well, we never had trouble publishing. Anything.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think it was a clear disagreement or two mm-hmm. scenarios which are clearly incompatible, mm-hmm. right? And so this is interesting. And a lot of people were aware of it. Anybody working in spin glasses was aware of it. But the thing is, you could do a lot of nice stuff in spin glasses without making any progress on that, right? Because the critical point was interesting and the non-equilibrium dynamics was very interesting. Not many people were really focused on trying to resolve this issue. And I'm probably, describing it very much with a hindsight, right? Because, now I think it's pretty clear that, if this is ever going to get resolved, it's going to probably be more from mathematical physics than from mm-hmm. the kind of thing that, from numerics or theory, the kind of theory that's been done so far.
But it was plausibly already on your mind by that point. That's what you're presenting.
And I think more so on Daniel's mind because he was working. He was working with mathematical physicists much. He had this nice paper with the Chases and Spencer about those inequalities. So mm-hmm. he really knew the mathematical physics community and what their strengths and possibilities were a lot more than I did.
As you were mentioning a bit earlier, and shortly after, even in the paper trail, you start to disengage from the spinning glass problem around the early 90s. What were you satisfied with what you had accomplished? Is this, did you feel that you had gone around the problem? Or otherwise, what drew you away at that point?
Well, just other things where I could, you know, it's a hard problem. And yeah, it wasn't clear what to do, you know, right. Of course, you know, and I got drawn away by interesting things that, high TC came along and it was related to quantum magnetism. And so I started working a lot in quantum magnetism, you know, and typically no disorder, you know, frustrated or whatever, strong quantum fluctuation. So I started doing that kind of stuff. And then we were doing the statistical mechanics of vortices in the high temperature supercritical. So that's a different aspect. You know, that was more, you know, the quantum magnetism was inspired by high temperature superconductors, but it had a life of its own, right? It was really just quantum magnetism, you know, which was a subject which needed working on, you know, and high TC got it started again. you know, and I've been working in that. I've worked on that problem for, you know, that in, I've been working in that area of, or I did work in that area for a long time after that. But then we started doing all this vortex dynamics stuff. And then there was a strong experimental program at Bell Labs doing that. And so I was spending a lot of time doing that. And of course, there was vortex glass. So there was a real connection to spin glasses. You know, the vortex glass is a type of XY spin glass, sort of. So there was a strong connection to spin glasses there. And that work was very directly inspired by thinking a lot about spin glasses. But yeah, those are two big subjects that, yeah, and we were able to, you know, really do some things there. Mm-hmm. Whereas the spin glass problem is like, most of the time when you try to do something, you get nowhere. So it's kind of...
So how, I mean...
But I remember one day, Chandra Varma, who was my colleague in the theory department, he came, I was working on quantum magnetism and I had worked on spin glasses, and he came to me one day and he said, "You know what, how come you don't do quantum spin glasses?" And I remember that very vividly, and I was thinking, yeah, that's a good idea. And so I started working on quantum spin glasses for a while, which eventually, you know, led, you know, and then Daniel was doing these random spin chains and this strong disorder renormalization group and the flow to infinite randomness. And so that's actually, you know, pretty related to the spin glasses. You know, in some sense, you know, a lot of the problems I've worked on since then, you know, they're not spin glasses directly, but if I hadn't worked on spin glasses, I probably wouldn't have been able to, you know, like many body localization, if I had never worked on spin glasses, I wouldn't be able to work on the problem that way. You know, it sort of gives a perspective on things that, you know, applies to a lot of problems, even though it's not explicitly doing spin glasses, but you're sort of, it gives you a way of thinking about things that has wide application. So I would say I didn't really, you know, totally move away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on, I worked on related problems that are, you know, one could make progress on. But I, you know, I remember when I did that work with Alan Middleton, I was like, you know, like students always come to me and say, "Oh, I want to work on spin glass." I always discourage them. I say, it's a horrible thing to work on because, you know, so many people worked on that for so long and made no progress. Right. And when Alan Middleton came to me and we did this project where we, you know, really made, I was like, wow, I made progress on a spin glass problem. It's really a spin glass problem for the first time in like 15 years. And, you know, I haven't since then.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever teach about spin glasses and or replica symmetry breaking at Princeton or elsewhere? And if yes, can you detail?
No.
Okay. So even though these ideas you found helpful and to carry over in a very different range of topics, it's still not something that you find pedagogically useful, or you just never taught a class where that would be relevant material?
Yeah, I never taught. Yeah, I never taught like a. That would be like a special topics course on, you know, advanced StatMech kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never taught that. When I teach those courses, I tend to do things that are more recent interests of mine, and so they tend to be much more quantum emphasized, quantum StatMech emphasized stuff. It never happened. Although I remember once before I came to Princeton, but not much before, Phil was teaching a course and he called me up and said he wanted me to come and give a lecture. So I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe I did actually give a lecture about it at Princeton before I came to Princeton in Phil's course.
So this would
I
have been.
I remember coming and giving a lecture from coming down from Bell Labs and giving a lecture. And I'm pretty sure it was about that, about spinglesses, but I'm not absolutely positive.
So this would have been an advanced StatMech class.
It would have been, yeah, some special topics advanced class that Phil was nominally teaching, but he was actually just bringing in guest lecturers. Although maybe he was lecturing. I really don't know.
Did he pay much attention to your work on spin glasses by then, or?
Well, I think he paid attention, but didn't really engage.
Okay, so because you were mentioning conversations you had later on with him, that was never on the theme of spin glasses. These were
No, it wasn't. Well, also, it's like, I've been working on this localization stuff for 15 years, and Phil was around and well aware of this for the first 10 years of it. Mm-hmm. And he never seemed interested. We were following up directly on his original paper, but he was interested in high temperature superconductivity, and he was interested. This is during the time while I was here. Mm-hmm. And then he got very interested in this super solid business. When that was going on. So I actually, the one time I wrote a paper with him was about super solids. But he kept that interest up for a long time after the rest of the community moved on. So we used to argue about that all the time. So I think the problem is, Phil's an interesting was an interesting person. I think he was interested in, he wasn't interested. It's like if he didn't disagree with me about something, he didn't really want to talk to me about it. Right? I think he liked topics where I would disagree with him about it, because he liked, he likes that. And so, we eventually got this real disagreement going about the super solid problem, and so he just loved to come in and talk to me about it. Whereas I think on the other thing, spin glasses and localization, we didn't disagree. And so there was no point in us talking about it from his point of view. Although that's just the impression I had. Because it seemed like,
From what we can tell, it seems that very few US-based physicists use ideas of replica symmetry breaking in the 80s and 90s. Do you have any perspective as to why that might be?
Well, there were some people. There was, what's his name, Goudschmidt, or
yes.
This guy in Pittsburgh? Goudschmidt. Yeah. He was doing it, seriously.
Mm-hmm. And Kardar.
Kardar. Mm-hmm. Kardar got some nice results from it. Not for necessarily for spin glasses, but for other problems. He was very proficient with it. But yeah, you're right. There was sort of the British American approach. And then the continental approach.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the Germans were maybe more in the British American camp, although that's not clear.
But so was this, I mean, was this really a cultural issue? Was this a pedagogical issue? Was this, do you have any opinion or
Well, there,
perspective?
there is this, real affection for nice mathematics, in the training for it, that you get in Paris that you don't get in the United States, and perhaps also not in the United Kingdom. So there's a certain, there is a certain culture of, a real strong mathematical background and an affection for those kinds of things, which I do associate, with, more with Paris.
I mean, you were earlier mentioning the exact results of Baxter, for instance. That's also, I mean, it's not an Anglo-American. He was in Australia, right? Is this also part of the cultural difference as well? Or.
It's interesting. Well, the Bernard Derrida is, he does beautiful exact results, very creative. So, I would say what he does, is more on the side of, what I'm calling the Anglo-American thing rather than the, the Mézard Parisi thing, right? So there's an example in Paris of someone very important in Paris who, it's really more exact results as opposed to field theory and creative. Although, so yeah, who else is doing exact results? Of course there was a strong culture of that in Holland and Elliot Leeb. Japan, there was what, Miwa Jimbo, there was this very strong group in Japan doing it back in those days. And also Russia, right? In some sense, all the conformal field theory and stuff, that's more in the spirit of well, I don't know. Yeah, actually, yeah, that I don't know. Yeah, I guess the conformal field theory stuff is it's in both camps, right? It's in both camps.
So we're coming to the close of this, we're nearing the close of this interview. So is there anything else you would like to share with us about that era that we may have missed or overlooked?
Well, we didn't talk about the experimental activities.
Were you
So,
following those closely?
yeah,
Okay.
and like one, I don't know. So there was, at Bell Labs, there was this beautiful experiment that Laurent Levy and Hélène Bouchiat did. You know this one, the nonlinear susceptibility done with AC methods. So that was going on.
So you were discussing with them,
Yeah, although, they knew what to do. The framework of what needed doing had been set out because they weren't trying to learn anything about the ordered phase. They were trying to learn about the critical point and, that the nonlinear susceptibility was the thing to look at. This, I think Suzuki was the first person to really spell that out clearly, I think, although I'm not sure. And so that was well formulated what needed to be done. Now, exactly the details of the scaling, we used to talk about that because, quite a bit.
So you were not an author on these papers because these were sort of informal conversations when you didn't.
You look back at those papers, I don't know. I remember talking with them. Whether we were acknowledged, I'm not sure. I'd have to look back and see. And there was also another experimentalist named Stan Geschwind, who was looking at cadmium manganese telluride and doing nonlinear susceptibility and also doing AC susceptibility. And I ended up working with him quite a bit and being on the papers with him. So that was experimental activity, again, about the critical point.
Okay.
just how to scale that data, you know, what's the best way to process that kind of take and analyze that kind of data to constrain the critical behavior of spin glasses. And then there was this paper. So there was this business about the remnant magnetization. So people were doing experiments where they would look at the remnant magnetization, and I was simulating that, and we realized it's actually, you know, you can if you polarize a spin glass and let it relax to its critical point as the remnant magnetization decay, which is a power law decay, it's the ferromagnet analog of that is to randomly polarize a ferromagnet and then look at the overlap with the initial state and how it decays as it relaxes to the critical point. And that's actually, and I did some simulations of this and some theory of this, and we found out there was this new non-equilibrium dynamic critical exponent, you know, which people had, you know, so at that time, and then there was, I'm trying to remember the guy's name, there was a RG person in Germany who worked out the epsilon expansion for that. And it was really, you know, so that was found. What's it called? The persistence exponent now, I think people call it. And it was, you know, we thought, oh, is this exponent related to some of the exponents that were already known? But no, it's a new non-equilibrium dynamic critical exponent. So that was another bit of theory that I did, you know, sometime around 1990. And, you know, there was a bunch of activity. And it was directly inspired by experiments, because, you know, that's a reasonably straightforward experiment, is take a spin glass. If you think you know its critical point, just look at the remnant magnetization decay at the critical point, which is just a power law. So it decays, you know, you can fit it over decades and, you know, really get good estimates of that. That's another thing that went on. So there, you know, there was a whole bunch of stuff having to do with non-equilibrium physics, which, you know, has become now, for me, that's about all I do now. You know, I hardly ever do equilibrium physics anymore. It's all non-equilibrium to first approximation these days, right? And so that was the beginnings of that back then.
You also, as you were just mentioning, numerical simulations that you ran. When did that become part of your toolkit? As far as I understand, there was none involved
with Henley. So the project. Well, I was doing a little bit of it as a grad student, but the paper with Henley, you know, in some sense, I wanted to do that project, but I didn't really know how to do the simulations, and Chris did. And so that's, I got him involved because so he could show me how to do that. You know, I had been doing a little bit of numerics, you know, as a grad student, but not very much. And then, you know, for a period, you know, until I was still doing a little bit of numerics after I came to Princeton, you know, doing some of them myself. But
you only started doing
since then, of course, it's just my students and postdocs are doing them, and I'm just supervising, making suggestions.
And in the context of spin glasses, your first simulations came, as you said, in around 1990. They were not at all involved in developing the droplet picture or in trying to test or examine it somehow. These were really independent. Is that correct?
Well, in terms of, yeah, me doing them, yes. But, you know, I did that transfer matrix calculation with Ingo. Of course, he did the actual calculations, but I was very involved. And I you know, did a paper with Ogelski about the random field problem. In fact, about the diluted antiferromagnet in a uniform field. So we did this simulation, which was very close to what they do in the experiment, and that I was very involved with. But of course, Andrew did all the simulations himself. Yeah, no, they just start doing. Yeah. But yeah. But yeah, you're right. It's probably the non-equilibrium stuff was the first time I myself was doing spin glass simulations.
In closing, do you still have notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Well, I noticed in looking at the transcripts that you ask a lot of people this stuff. So I actually looked. Now I've moved many times, and my office got renovated. And it turns out the only thing I have is the transparencies. It looks like I kept the transparencies from every talk I gave, but that's all I have. But yeah, and what'll happen to those, I don't know.
So including talks about the spin glasses, what these talks that you were giving around the U.S.
I assume I have. It looks like I've got this great big box, which is just, it looks like it's transparencies from every talk I ever gave.
If ever we get around to scanning one or two of them, we'd certainly appreciate getting a look at the. That said, thank you very much for your time. It's been a real pleasure in discussing.
Yeah, so maybe I'll take a look at them and see if there's some from particularly the era you're focused on. And maybe maybe there's ones that would be of interest to you. Now that I see the focus of the particular time you want to ask about, I'll see if I have those.
Thank you.